The Toronto Maple Leafs answered all the questions yesterday with a 2-1 victory over the Montreal Canadiens. Gord Stellick in studio, he of Leafs Nation pre and post, getting ready for another game tonight in Ottawa, Leafs and Senators. How's it going, Gord?
Well, good. So they answered all the questions. Was it, I mean, it was a pop quiz, right? I mean, that's a pop quiz, about four or five questions. But yeah, they did okay.
What is the mood of the nation? Because that's what we have you here. You are the guy who tells us what the mood of the nation is.
The mood of the nation is just like, it's an interesting, it's a funny time in Toronto sports. There's the enthusiasm of being back in the buildings. Mm-hmm. And the Leaf fans, I think, are excited about that. But then everything we talk about game number 83. So that always ends up being the mood about, hey, what's the goaltending like this year compared to whatever? How about the new guys, you know, whatever? And you forget that last year, if you want to get the right mood, they actually answered all the check marks in the regular season.
That's
in a
right.
56, but people have forgotten about that. So there's just assumed they're going to do that. That's kind of the mood, Stephen, which I don't, you know, it's kind of like you're holding a party and everyone assumes it's going to be a great party all the time. That's a lot of pressure. That's a lot of pressure, right? You know, kind of thing. And then you get a clunker.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned that they answered some of the questions. One of the questions was, can you play a more playoff-style game during the regular season, which they did. They were a better defensive team during the 56-game season. They were able to play boring games like yesterday. Is that what we're going to see 81 more times, a game that's like kind of low event like that? Would they like that?
Well, actually, I should say, number one thing in the mood is Leaf Nation's tired of playing Ottawa. Okay, so why did they get all these teams front-loaded? Like, let's play some of the teams we didn't last year. I'm saying, you know, I heard Kipper talking with Justin Bourne earlier, and I keep thinking, like, and Brendan Shanahan, it's always interesting because he subscribes to this as well, even though he's the kind of player they could really use nowadays, that the biggest form of intimidation is Patrick Kane wearing you out all the time as Chicago won 3 Stanley Cups. That when you turn around, he's on top of you, you give away the, you know, and I'm just saying that's what they sculpted this team to be like. So a team like Ottawa tonight, I know they get the psychological lift that Tkachuk has signed. He's not going to play, but that's a psychological boost. Pedal to the metal. I don't care. You don't need to rough Tim Stützle. Flex your muscle. Win it about 6-1, right? You know, some of the playoff games are closer. But you know what? Beat the teams. You give them a good thump every now and then that you should. And Ottawa, to me, is ripe for that.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that, you know, like, I think the Ottawa's going to come out like they're shot out of a cannon tonight, though, right? Like, a young team, as you say, the Tkachuk thing is good news. That was the one thing that was kind of hanging over them. I know there's always something going on in Ottawa. But, you know, a young team, presumably on the rise, opening night against the Leafs. You would think they're going to have a lot of juice.
Well, you'd hope, but that's the miss. Matthews usually scores 4 goals in these games, right?
There's
in Ottawa, the season opening game there. But yeah, I would, and of course Matt Murray. Of course, their goaltending's really been in flux, and Matt Murray not going to be able to play. Missing Colin White, missing Tkachuk still. But yeah, I mean, I like that team, Ottawa, but I worry about them quite often because we saw it before in Toronto. You know, before Lou came and sort of the template, and they had those draft picks, fortuitous draft picks early, that you'd make a step and the next year you go backwards. Like, you remember bringing Bernier and Boland and Clarkson, my God, over, you know. So Ottawa's a little bit, well, except they've got a better nucleus of young talent. But I still think, you know, you can have all the momentum, energy and that and that. But I just think the Leafs, you know, certain times you got to flex your muscle, you know, and part of an 82-game season. I'm not saying it has to be tonight necessarily, but certain nights you got to play like you're at the big table and some of them are at the kids' table, okay?
I would like that because that sounds a little more entertaining than 2-1 against the Montreal Canadiens. I don't know how Sheldon Keefe would feel about it. I mean, hey, listen, if it's them putting up 6 and the Ottawa Senators putting up 1, I'm sure he would like that, but I don't think he wants to see 6-4. William Nylander scores yesterday, you know, with all the negative feelings after the 7-game series against the Montreal Canadiens and Matthews and Marner only combining for 1 goal, he was great in that series. Like, and we don't talk about it because, you know what? Nothing was great because the result was so bad. But you want to talk about somebody showing up for that thing. It was, I think he scored 5 times in that 7-game series. He plays the most minutes of just about everybody yesterday. He looks great. Like, he kind of feels like the forgotten man at times with this team. And he's actually under a contract that is commensurate with what he provides.
Yeah, he's the hockey version of cold case files because they go back to the holdout all the time, right? Instead of like, hey, do you understand the last couple of years he's kicked ass? And even when we get back to playoffs, let's talk, you know, Mitch Marner had a phenomenal playoff against the Boston Bruins. Like, that's what bothers me is when they talk about this learning thing and you go, no, wait a sec. Some of these guys have done this in the playoffs before, okay? But you're right. With Nylander's, wherever you, like, to have that kind of guy, like, number four, theoretically, among your forwards, that's what blows your mind sometimes when you see that. And I liked last night. He's better when he shoots more. He had five shots last night. And he also, different areas, like in close and that, and then that nice one he picked the corner. But, yeah, he's, again, you got this kind of skill, and that's the kind of thing that ultimately will win the day if your skill can come to the forefront.
He's got crazy skill. Like, yeah. I just don't think they're ever going to fall in love with him here.
I don't know with all the team right now. It's just once they have playoff success, which means one round. I'm telling
That's
you,
it.
One round, they'll be a parade. Okay, they'll be a parade. And so right now, the rock stars are Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner. Mm-hmm. It was even funny when John Tavares got signed, he was the story. Uh-huh. And that's where there was a miscalculation that they should have quickly got Matthews and Marner if they could have right after that. Then the season started, and the rock stars 10 games in right again were Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner. John Tavares was great, but those two guys were the rock stars. So, I mean, he's like William Nylander's George Harrison, okay?
Mm-hmm. He wrote Taxman.
And unfortunately, it means he'd be deceased too, I guess, if he was George Harrison. So
you have to go dark like that.
How about Ringo? Yes. How about Ringo? Ringo. Let's make him Ringo.
Ringo. I don't know if he wants to be Ringo.
Yeah, Ringo sucked. Let's just
be straight
up.
Okay. Yeah. That beats sucking.
Yes, that's true. Being alive beats sucking.
All right. They scored on the power play yesterday. There's no transition.
No.
They scored on the power play yesterday. Pierre Engvall.
Yeah.
The much maligned Pierre Engvall. That has been a large point of discussion this offseason. And I go back and forth on how important it is because, on the surface, you're like, well, this team's good enough. Like, the power play is that. But then you look at the last three games and how close the margin was. I mean, two of those things going to overtime against Montreal and going, I think they were 0-for-7 on the power play in those final three games actually might be more important than I even realized, because this team has not had a problem scoring even strength.
Yeah.
Like, them being a top five power play team would indicate what for you as far as their playoff success?
Well, I mean, that's where they were at the start of the season. Did you see that graphic yesterday each month?
Mm-hmm.
Like that?
Oh, yeah, that was
if that was your cholesterol level, you'd be dead,
yeah.
Okay? Like, it was, you know,
keep bringing it back,
it started up at number one, and then it went, went down to. Now, I know Scotty Bowman's decades ago, but every now and then you can, but he would talk about the great Montreal Canadian power play. And he said, sometimes we practice it, but Guy Lafleur would screw it up all the time. Like, whatever it was. Then you said, okay, let's just go play, and these five talented guys would have the best power play in the league. I'm not saying it's that simple. Okay, I'm not saying that at all. But I just thought, like last year, you had it. It's not like you never achieved it. You had that great power play, and then it became because of the overemphasized, the overanalyzing. They always flash to the power play coach, kind of like a pitching coach in baseball or a defensive coordinator in the NFL now that they're supposed to take the blame. So I guess now the point is you want to keep it moving more. You want to keep it moving more. The one downside there is if you're all moving and the puck goes loose, then all of a sudden you could be giving up shorthanded opportunities and shorthanded chances. But I'm just, you had the recipe, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert about that recipe. And maybe you're over-tweaking at some points. But at least they got that one, granted, with like 1/10 of a second left in the power play. So it's a start.
But boy, the recipe, like how many times during over the course of last season did you ask, like, I defer to those guys, like Justin Bourne, who can actually explain that stuff. I mean, how can those guys on the ice not be a great power play?
Yeah.
Explain this to me.
They didn't score last 14 games last year. Last 14 power game, no power play goal.
So I don't know enough. And, and I heard various explanations, but even those guys couldn't explain it.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't really explain it.
Yeah. I mean, if we could, we should be on the coaching staff then or whatever. We should be playing on the power play. And I wonder, like, in all seriousness, when you start overthinking, really, when you start overthinking in life, we have different producers or different, whether PDs and that. You've gone through it, Steven. You've been through it. Like, and all of a sudden you get the micromanaging, mm-hmm. which to a degree can help, or the person that leaves you alone, whatever. And sometimes when you're micromanaged, it's constructed. Then after a while, like, you don't know what the hell you're doing.
I have a theory.
What's mm-hmm. that?
They're not getting enough opportunities, right? That they're not getting enough practice. And you can debate why they haven't drawn many penalties. They've been amongst the worst team in the NHL in power play opportunities over the last year. Is there some sort of
conspiracy?
Yeah, when I was general manager, that's what it was. That's what drove me out of the league. Everyone was against Toronto.
Well, but and I believe that is in part true. But I would say what's more likely is that you don't have players that draw penalties. Now, Nazem Kadri was like a notorious penalty drawer until the officiating came around to understanding that that's exactly what his intent was. Michael Bunting draws a penalty yesterday. Like, we just talked about Team Canada, the soccer team, flopping a little bit more in these games against CONCACAF teams. Does there need to be another element of that? Can Michael Bunting draw more penalties for the Toronto Maple Leafs so they have more opportunities?
Well, you expect your star players to draw penalties generally, right? That's kind of the skill. And nowadays that so much is not allowed. And this year they've even had a further crackdown on cross-checking. Because every rule is made to punish defense, and Colin Campbell says this, and try to get the skill, allow the skilled players an offense. So I continue to be baffled about it. And by the way, practice time, because that used to be it. A coach would always say, we can't find practice time. And now they cancel practices all the time. They need more rest. And I'm not, you know, I don't know what the happy medium is, but, you know, just there isn't as much practice time as there used to be. But I don't get it. I don't get it. Your skilled players should draw a lot of penalties. So, you know, you want them to go out thinking about creating score. Like, if you're going out trying to score a goal, crash to the net, create a scoring chance, then you can also draw a penalty.
Well, that's it. But maybe that's part of the discussion, is that when they create offense, and that would go to the playoff style of play as well, is that creating scoring chances closer to the net will, one, increase your power play opportunities, and two, it's, you know, you don't get a lot of beautiful goals in the postseason. That should be a point of emphasis for this game.
That was one thing Craig Simpson was pointing out last night. If you watch the game, just said there seemed to be a guy in front of that all the time. That seemed to be a notable difference, that almost 100% of the time in the offensive zone, there seemed to be a player, not just Wayne Simmonds, you know, who's a no-brainer, but someone else that was doing it. And so I would throw that one in, that maybe in the mix, that, you know, I still, like, the last three games are just a blur what happened, okay? It's just like a bad, it's like looking at your exam where you got 20%. What's the point? You're not going to look at it over and over again. But the point about just, you know, why did your crowd carry Price more? You know, maybe you couldn't. I don't know. But afterwards. But so I do see that, to your point. I think it's a valid point. The mantra, like, okay, let's get in that. Like, John Tavares plays in the greasy area. I like that. He does play in the greasy area, but it's more for skill reasons. But let's get guys in the greasy area that either can make something. Like, you saw Brendan Gallagher take that whack, right? The late whack. Let's get a little bit about that. And that maybe could draw a few more penalties.
I guess, is Mrazek playing tonight?
Mrazek's playing tonight.
So, you know, now that we're in the, you know, the Freddie Anderson, endless Freddie Anderson conversation debate that went on, you know, almost through his entire time here, now that's over, how do you feel about the goaltending, Gord? How good does Mrazek have to be? How durable is he? Like, how much of a role does he have to play?
Well, you know, again, I really like Freddie, but the playoffs were his undoing.
Yeah.
So he left town quietly because of that. I like Peter Mrazek's won in the playoffs before, so I think that matters for something. I love his personality. So it's going to be a 50-50 thing pretty well, because you got to have two options in the playoffs, right? You got to have two options, because last year Jack Campbell had a really good season, great regular season. But he also got out goaltended in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. He didn't play terrible. But he also, and every year Freddie got out goaltending, you're saying, wait a sec, we had 6 years of Curtis Joseph and Ed Belfour. Just ask Ottawa Senator fans what the difference that is in the playoffs. So I like the tandem. They're going to play more as a tandem. And then, you know, hopefully, again, with everything, have more of a state to have success in each of your positions and as a team come the playoffs.
Last one, because we know you have to go. Penny Oleksiak, with all her medals, getting all tangled up.
Yeah.
She survived. not that. The way she was carrying those medals in a sock. She was transporting the medals in a wool sock.
Yeah.
Your thoughts, Gord?
I wonder if it has some kind of special inherent value there because it was funny. What do we get her like? Like, you put your headsets on, they're tangled all the time.
Yes.
And I mean, maybe it was metals. That would be great to have that problem. But yeah, she carries it in a sock. And
yeah. I guess it's as good a place as any. You saw it. I would have never thought to go to sock, but I guess. When you accumulate medals, you're looking for something.
Well, think at your house. Not the way you want anyone's house to get burglarized, but if they're looking for medals, they probably would never look in the sock, right?
Yeah, not the sock drawer.
So that might be it. But boy, what a that was nice seeing her there. But it was funny after. Who has trouble unraveling all their medals? That's a great predicament to have.
Yeah, it's not a lot of people that have to deal with that problem. Gord, thank you for this,
gentlemen.
Thanks for dropping by.
Pleasure. Take care, man.
All right, see ya. There's Gord Stellick getting ready for Leafs Nation. Pre and post game with Brent Gunning here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Leafs and Ottawa Senators, first of two They play him tonight. They play him on Hockey Night in Canada back at Scotiabank Arena. And a game that at last check before we started the show, again, was not sold out. Mm-hmm. The game yesterday was not sold out. I'm going to keep an eye on this. And I there's potential mitigating factors. But like we said yesterday, it's still very bizarre. Like, there's been mitigating factors for a while. And
yes, there are decades of them, actually. Yes.
And there has not been an issue filling that barn. It's still bizarre. And it was almost full, right? I think they announced more than 19,000 yesterday.
Yeah, it looked fullish on TV for sure. Yes.
But not all the way full. So,
no. Leaf attendance crisis. That would be the great. I didn't think I'd live long enough for that one.
Yeah, and we'll see. I don't know. Coming up tonight, man, you can't. I'm trying to rack my brain for just season series that have been more tightly contested than the Dodgers and Giants. They have exactly 109 victories each because, of course, the Dodgers had to play an extra game. They played the wild card game, and they both have two wins in this National League division series. Game five goes tonight. I mean, it's another great day of sports watching for everybody. You got the Leafs, and then you got a good Thursday nighter actually as well with the Eagles and Buccaneers. And then at 9 o'clock, you got this game five, which you can watch on Sportsnet.
And it's great that, as you know, there's other stuff going on, but that as a ball game, it stands alone, right? Like, yep. you have a lot of days this part of the playoffs in baseball where you have multiple games going. It's great that this game is just this game tonight because it should be. It deserves to be.
It absolutely deserves to be. We deserve John Morosi. We've been good enough. Let's talk to him right now. He of MLB Network, SiriusXM, MLB Radio, joins us live from Houston ahead of the American League Championship Series. How's it going, John?
Ben and Steven, you are far too kind, my friends. Appreciate the introduction. But, yeah, it's just great to be here. ALCS game one tomorrow. But as I heard Steven saying before I popped on the air, the game tonight, Dodgers-Giants, I'm sure we've all acknowledged what Vin Scully said, greatest ever game between these teams.
Yeah.
I'll co-sign that, and I can't wait to see what happens tonight.
Oh, I'm ecstatic for it. And even though it starts late, I hope it goes like 15 innings, because that would be dramatic. is this the World Series? Is the winner of this thing going to go the route?
You know, great question. I think that these have both been the deepest teams in baseball this year. I will say, I think Houston's lineup, just looking at their players here today, I mean, they've got a tremendous lineup. The Red Sox, obviously, they've really cohered together very well, and I like what they've got right now from the standpoint of their vibe. And then, of course, Atlanta, we can't forget what they did knocking out the Brewers in four games. So I do think that the winner of this game tonight emerges as the favorite to win the World Series, but I would really be reluctant to say that they are the overwhelming favorites overall to win it all, just because I think that we've seen glimpses of excellence from all the remaining teams.
Yeah, it's weird things happen, right, in a short series, et cetera. Like, again, as you were saying that, I'm thinking, well, Houston would give either one of them a go, but I can't believe the Red Sox are where they are. And, you know, God love Atlanta, and they've overachieved, and they did beat a really good Milwaukee team, but you kind of stack them up against either of these other two, I don't see it. But, you know, look, weirder things have happened, but I'm trying to come up with a comparable for this, where you have two teams, you know, 107 win, 106 win, whether both 109 wins has been said at this stage in the season. They are the, you know, runaway two best teams in baseball playing an elimination game at this point in the playoffs, where there is literally nothing to choose between the two of them, right? Like, this, whatever happens after this, again, I think this game literally and figuratively stands alone, John. I don't have a lot of parallels for this.
There isn't one. And I think, Stephen, to your point, we don't get a chance to say it very often in sports, but there is really nothing that we can compare this to. First of all, the rivalry itself, mm-hmm, is unique in American sports, because there's no rivalry in any of the major sports in North America, really, that has picked up and migrated from one coast to the other and still been as great in the new place as it was in the old place. that doesn't exist in anything else. It's not as though the Red Sox and Yankees began in Santa Monica and Venice Beach, I mean, and then moved to east. That didn't happen. So, I mean, it's a very unique story in and of itself. And then for only to happen, this is the third time they've ever played a winner-take-all game. That's unique. the history between them, the number of times that one has knocked out the other. You think about the Joe Morgan home run in 1982, obviously the Bobby Thompson home run in 51. There's just a lot of rivalry there to think about. And it's the whole geography of it all and the multi-generational nature of the fan bases and how there are still people. You're doing the math here, and it's obviously, for those who remember the Giants and Dodgers in the early 50s, I mean, it's actually not, basically, you could have been a kid of 10 or 11 years old in 51 and remembered that, and you would have been born in 40. So, I mean, there's still a lot of people in the world who know what that was like and can talk about that. So it's a pretty unique set of circumstances, I think, overall, and just the excellence of it. And to me, guys, I know all of us, when we broadcast and write, we're thinking about parallel seek to explain and say, well, here's a little bit of context on what could happen. But I think it's also okay for us to say, Stephen, as you just did, that we have never seen this before, because we haven't. I mean, there's never quite been a game like this ever. Mm-hmm. And so it's pretty cool to be able to say that in this point, and then just to appreciate and enjoy the characters as they unfold on our screens and all the things that are at stake and the players who are, you know, entering free agency. So as of the end of today, either Corey Seager or Chris Bryant's going to be a free agent, and that's going to be the last game they play before that. I mean, that's obviously a very micro example of that. You got a guy like Gavin Lux from Kenosha, Wisconsin, who always was an infielder, all of a sudden now starting in center field for the Dodgers in this incredible game. There's just some great storylines there. And, of course, the opener, you got that aspect of it, and when does Urias come in the game? The intrigue and the layers, guys, it's just there is nothing that we have ever seen like this game.
Yeah, and who knows if we see it again between these two franchises, because you mentioned the free agents. We know the Giants are an older team, and a lot of those older players are kind of having resurgent years. The Giants have always been in and around the best teams in baseball, and they've won a bunch of World Series in recent memory. But yeah, who knows? This could be kind of a one-off for the next couple of years. You mentioned the opener thing kind of caught people by surprise. Urias is pretty good. It's not like he's not a starter. What do you make of the Dodgers going with the opener instead of just a traditional starter tonight?
Well, it certainly fits within their ethos. It's maybe not the way that we all grew up with the game, but it's the way that it's managed now. And clearly, this is a manifestation of the way the Dodgers process works. There's always a lot of conversation between the front office and the manager and the staff about how to do things. And this is one thing where perhaps would Dave Roberts have, if he had had his way, would it have just been Urias starting the game? Maybe. Because that's just a natural thing. You got a guy who's a Cy Young candidate and a winner-take-all game on the road. If I'm Dave Roberts, just emotionally, I would want the first guy touching the ball to be my guy. I mean, Urias, in many ways, with all apologies to Max Scherzer, has been their best pitcher from the start of the season to now. And obviously, Max wasn't there to begin with. But he is so important to them, Urias is. So I think we can see why they're doing it. They want to force the Giants to make a tough decision about their platoon split. They're a very platoon-heavy team. So the question that Gabe Kapler is going to have is, okay, do you start your lefty bat right now to get the at-bat against Knebel, knowing that Urias is probably in by the second or third inning? And if he is, then all of a sudden you've got all your lefty bats in the lineup and they're going to have to deal with a lefty start. Clearly, I think we know why they're doing it. It's legal. It's forthright. It's the way the game works now. But you know, this is not Jack Morris and John Smoltz in 1991. You know, it's not that. And I think we have to realize just how much the game has changed, that you don't get a chance to feel that rhythm even 10 years ago, the late Roy Halladay and Chris Carpenter, that game 5 in the division series then. It was the same thing, two greats going at it for 8, 9, 10 innings. And it's not that anymore. The game has changed too much.
John, well, we got you here. This is some other baseball news today. Let's start with we don't talk about Mike Schilt a whole lot in this town. But you know, as the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals, he did a hell of a job this year. I thought, you know, they went on a crazy run, couldn't lose for a long stretch, made it to the postseason again. How does he get fired today?
It's a great question, Stephen. It's certainly the news broke. I was here on the field in Houston, you know, hours ago when that story came across the wire, so to speak, and there were a lot of stuff. The media room, there were a lot of stunned looks on the field, like, man, did you hear what happened with Schilt? I mean, people are surprised for all the reasons that you mentioned. They had a very strong finish of the season. John Mozeliak saying that there were philosophical differences Now, you know, John is analytical. He is not the most analytical, but he is an analytical guy. And so was Mike pushing back on some of the more analytical suggestions that John Mozeliak in the front office had? Perhaps. Now, Mike Schilt is a really good baseball guy. He's a little bit old school, you know, schooled by George Kistel and all the greats of the Cardinal way and the fundamentals and you know, the teaching of the game from the earliest levels in the Cardinal system. That's sort of his background. And so that's not really the background that maybe John Mozeliak wanted to have to integrate the new information that we see managers excelling at now. Now, the question here is, okay, so who's next? Who are you going to hire instead? And this job, on the face of it, is a very appealing one. So, like, would a veteran manager like a John Gibbons want this? I'm sure he would, but it probably doesn't. That's probably not the kind of manager the Cardinals are looking for if they're moving on from someone who's been a little bit older school. And so this is where it's going to be a real interesting situation, because they may go with someone who was already on the staff, but was a bit more analytical. Stubby Clapp is obviously one possibility. The great Canadian is one option here to have this job. But I think if you're an outsider looking for your first job, maybe if you're a Skip Schumacher, who has obviously played for the Cardinals, but you look at it and say, wait a minute, I'm walking into a situation where a popular manager just got fired, and one of my first jobs is going to be to tell Yadier Molina in his final season when he's not going to be in the lineup, when Yadier, if it was up to him, would be playing 162. That's a hard job. So I think they may stay within, which is what they've done the last couple hirings. Of course, Schilt was an internal hire. Mike Matheny was within the Cardinal family, too, and those are the only two managers besides La Russa to have this job. So unique organization, successful team this year, and certainly, Stephen, from that standpoint, a stunning decision today by the St. Louis Cardinals.
Yeah, blew me away. John, wish we had more time. We got to run, though. Good to talk to you.
Great talking to you guys, and the Leafs are underway. Wings are playing tonight, my friends. We're going to get a look at Lucas Raymond in the wing wheel. I can't wait.
Yeah.
But that'll be before Dodgers-Giants, okay?
All right. Okay. Us neither. The Detroit Red Wings. We're excited
about
that. See you,
John.
I'm excited. Thanks so much, guys. Take care. Yeah. Thank you.
Got to admit, Detroit Red Wings, not forefront of mind for me.
Well, I grew up loving them, so I can still. I'll. It's going to be a tough year. I believe it's going to be a tough year. There's my hockey prediction.
That's good.
Wings are going to have a tough year.
I think that's probably accurate. That was John Morosi, MLB Network. All right, when we come back, we'll talk to broadcast legend Peter Mansbridge, of course, host of the National until 2017, has a new book, Off the Record. We'll talk to him about that coming up next. It is the Fan Drive Time. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. All right, our next guest was the host of the National, 1988 to 2017. He covered 13 Olympics, 14 federal elections, has a new book, Off the Record. It is Peter Mansbridge who joins us online right now. How's it going, Peter? Thanks for doing this.
It's going really well, gentlemen. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you. I was, you know, looking out for you yesterday, watching the Leaf game. They open up their season against the Montreal Canadiens, packed house, and you know, it's celebrity encounters occasionally happen in the city. I didn't see you. What was going on?
I was selling my book. You know, Brunt knows what this is like. You know, you have a book, and they push you to do one promotional gig after another. And it just launched last week. It's a successful launch. I mean, it debuted at number one on the charts that came out last night. So I'm feeling good about that. But I had to do an event last night. So by the time I got home, I gave my tickets to one of my buddies. And by the time I got home, I was able to watch a good chunk of it.
Well, there you go. And they won. So that's what's important, right? So
that's right.
And selling books is important too. And I will get to the book. Never mind the hockey game last night. Where did you spend election night? Because you know, I Rosie and Barton and crowd, they did a great job and they were awesome.
Yep.
But you know, I missed you and Bob Ray doing the shtick from last time. That was a highlight for me. But you know, I don't know. Like, how many times have you watched an election as a civilian? It's got to be a while, right?
The last one I watched as a civilian was 68. So I've been in a CBC studio every election since 72. So this was a first for me, and I actually quite enjoyed it because I had the opportunity to watch everybody. You know, I, all those other years, I'd never seen any other coverage. And so I, this gave me the opportunity to watch other networks, see how they do things, you know, watch the ups and downs of television coverage on election night. It's the biggest, you know, night of the kind of news calendar is an election night. So when you you have that opportunity to be involved in that show, you you love it.
All right, let's sell some more books, Peter. It sounds incredible, and of course, an incredible career, host of the National for all those years. And I mentioned the 13 Olympics, 14 federal elections. Can you, what is your favorite story from the book that you tell?
Well, there's a lot of stories in there, and it's hard to, you know, when you've been around that long, that's a kind of a 50-year career. There are a lot of big moments, you know, being in Berlin when the wall came down, you know, 44 hours in the studio during 9/11. You know, all the various election nights, which are big, as I just mentioned, and conventions, the big interviews. I mean, they all, you know, as I was writing that book, I suddenly realized how lucky I'd been to have been in all these different places, to have met and interviewed all these different, you know, world figures, sports figures, arts figures, lots of different people, and you know, it was an incredible opportunity that the CBC in that case gave me.
What was it? What, you know, I was wondering what it was like. You know, look, I was raised as a, you know, as a newspaper guy, and you know, where you using the word "I" was verboten, right? You weren't supposed to, you know, you keep yourself out of it. What was it like turning the camera around, you know, or turning the gaze around and looking at your own life? Because it doesn't come naturally to us, I would say.
No, it doesn't. It was different for sure. And I learned a lot about myself because I'd never done it that way before. I'd never, you know, looked at my, you know, the things that I'd done in a particular way. You know, I learned stuff about my childhood by sitting down with my sister, who's a couple of years older than me, things I hadn't realized about, you know, I was born in England, raised in Southeast Asia, and there were things that happened that, you know, because I was at such a young age during those years, that I didn't realize. But yet they seem to have had an impact on me through my life. You know, it is different. When you see the word "I," you're right. You feel very uncomfortable putting in a story you're writing. But at the same time, I'd, you know, dinners with friends over the years, they always ask you questions about what was such and such an event like, what was such and such a person like. You know, when they said, well, you know, what was it like to interview Barack Obama in the White House? Well, they don't want to hear about the interview. They want to hear about what it was like in the White House, right?
Yeah.
What else was going on? So the stories are the stories behind the stories. And I've kind of told them to friends over the years. This was simply a matter of, you know, sitting down and writing them out for everybody to read.
And that's kind of the book is kind of structured that way. I think people are going to like that, you know, because it is kind of like sitting down over a beer and saying, hey, what was it like that time? Now, there's stuff in there I didn't, like, again, I knew a little bit of your origin, the airport origin story, which is kind of a legendary story. But, I didn't know you and your sister were in that documentary with Diefenbaker. Like, that's a very cool story, right? I had no idea. It's kind of, the picture's hilarious.
It is hilarious, isn't it? I was 10 years old, and my sister and I, and we were relatively new to Canada. We still had English accents, but we were picked as two typical Canadians to take a tour of the Parliament buildings. It was a film the National Film Board was doing that went into every school in the country, and I'm sure it's probably still in some schools on, you know, the basement archives area. But, you know, we spent a week on Parliament Hill, and the last scene that we shot was in the Prime Minister's office, and the Prime Minister of the day then, 1958, was John Diefenbaker. And, you know, we spent about, you know, it was a huge thrill. We spent like 15 minutes in there. And, you know, he was very, you know, kind to us. Spent time, small talk, all that, while the camera crews got their shots.
I imagine you saw television journalism change quite a bit over your time at the National. And then post your time at the National, what television journalism has become today. What have you noticed with the changing landscape of journalism?
Well, journalism in general has changed, not just television journalism. You know, there's so many more organizations now than there were when I started. In television, there were only just two in terms of network television, CTV and CBC. Now there are literally, you know, there are dozens, really, when you count them all in terms of cable news networks, specialty channels, everybody trying to grab the story. So you go into events where there are dozens of journalists and camera crews kind of mobbing the scene. Now, not every news organization operates the same. The media is not a monolith, so there's, you know, different practices and different standards and guidelines that different organizations apply to themselves. And as a result of that, there have been, you know, there are clearly issues in terms of the relationship between the news media and the people, not just the news media and the people they cover, but the news media and the people they serve, the, you know, the customers, the viewers, the listeners, the readers. And there are challenges in those relationships right now, and they're all built around one word, and that's trust. You know, they want to be convinced that what we're telling them is real. And we've never had that problem before. Now we do, and it's greater than a lot of people think. And we've got to be aware of that and deal with it in a very transparent way.
One of the things, you know, I got a hold of the book, and I've been jumping back and forth, which, again, it kind of allows you to do that, Peter. You know, and there's lots of stuff there about, you know, as you say, the, you know, world events that you've covered and prime ministers. I was thinking you were going to tell me that Stephen Harper was a flesh and blood human being in there, and I know that's kind of the headline in the chapter, but I was unconvinced afterwards. But I'll tell you, a lot of people are going to do what I did. You know, the first piece I read was the piece about Gord Downie. And, you know, you broke my heart all over. And I got to say that, you know, that interview, I think, you know, for a lot of Canadians, that was, you know, a powerful and beautiful and shattering thing to watch. You can talk a little bit about, you know, your side of it, because I know you write about it in the book and your relationship with Gord. I didn't know you met him on a golf course, but I wouldn't have guessed. But it's very cool. It's a beautiful piece. It was such an amazing, you know, it's such an amazing moment of Canadian history, never mind Canadian television.
Well, he was a pretty special guy to all of us, you know. He's kind of a poet laureate in many ways in terms of the music he and the Tragically Hip brought to us, told us about our country. But in those last couple of years of his life, he was also calling upon us for action on the Indigenous rights issue and on residential schools. And, you know, he wanted us to recognize what had happened in the past and work towards reconciliation. And he talked about that all the time. That was his kind of mission in the last 2 years. He knew he was dying. We knew he was dying. And yet he wanted to use that time for something truly meaningful beyond just his music. And so that's what he wanted to talk about often. He talked about it throughout that final tour across the country. But, you know, because I'd known him for about 20 years, you know, we weren't close, but we knew each other and we called upon each other's help at different times for various reasons. But here we were sitting down, first interview he'd given since the news of the cancer that was eating him away. The concert tour he devoted all his energies to was over, so it really was, you know, the final months. And so, you know, we sat down, and one of the first things that I noticed was that he had written my name on the palm of his hand. And there were a lot of other things written there, too, but I could see in big letters my name. And I said, what's that for? And he said, well, in case I forget, your name. And I said, Gord, we've known each other 20 years. He said, yeah, but it's eating my brain. And I forget things. You know, on the tour, he had to have all the songs on a prompter in case he forgot the lyrics that he'd been singing for decades. And the same thing was about the interview. Now, in the interview, he said, I'm going to have to stop every 5 or 10 minutes. And as it turned out, he didn't. We went for more than an hour. He never looked at his palm. But he was, you know, at times struggling to put the right words together that he wanted to use to describe the situation, not only that he was in, but he felt the country was in. But it was, you know, it was tough. You remember in that last few months, he always wanted to, whoever he met, whether he'd ever met them before or not, didn't matter. He wanted to kiss them when he left.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the interview, he leaned towards me and he said, can I kiss you? And I said, of course, Gordon. And, you know, and we kissed like everybody in that room. You know, we were in a kind of rehearsal room. It was too much, you know. And then he just moved over and he started singing. And he sang one of the songs from Secret Path, that final album he did in tribute to the young indigenous fellow who had died trying to walk home
Channing Wenjack.
And you know, that's all you could hear in that room. And as I wrote in the book, all you could hear was the sound of a dying man singing. And you know, it was quite the moment, you know, one that we all still think of, because he was such an incredible guy and meant so much to so many of our lives in different ways, right up to the end.
Well, you know, again, you think of the sometimes as the journalist as dispassionate observer, right? But that's sometimes it's the passionate observer, right? That line gets crossed every once in a while.
It does, and you know, it certainly did there. You couldn't hold back your feelings for a guy who was, you know, your friend. But he was a friend to so many people who had never met him, right? And he always will be. And I guess the beauty of music, almost more than anything else, any other art form, is that it's there forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there will be people long after we're all gone who will be listening to Gord Downie and the Tragically Hip and looking for more and more information that they can find about who this guy was. Like, why did he sound like that? And why did he write like that, you know? Because it was so Canadian. It's like, you know, it's funny. I was thinking of it just a couple of weeks ago when Norm Macdonald died.
Mm.
Now, Norm Macdonald and Gord Downie are two very different kinds of people. But they're both Canadian. And part of their magic as artists was that we Canadians could see it sometimes in both Downie and Macdonald when others couldn't. You know, I mean, he became extremely popular, Norm Macdonald, across the United States, and deservedly so. But initially, they didn't get his humor, but we did, because mm-hmm. it's Canadian.
Yeah.
You know, there was a Canadian element to his humor. And with Gord Downie, same thing, his music, very Canadian.
Well said, Peter. The book, again, is Off the Record, Peter Mansbridge. Peter, thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Stephen. You guys take care.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks, Peter. Congrats on the book.
Peter Mansbridge.
Thanks, Stephen.
Peter Mansbridge.
It's a fun book.
Yeah.
It is a blast. So, yeah, it's...
It's like bite-sized, right?
Yep, it is. It's which is an interesting decision. You know, that's a different... It's a way of doing it. I think people are going to like it. There are, you know, and again, some of it's heavy, you know, if you want to know about what it was like to cover the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to know what it was like hanging out with Ringo, who's only 5 feet, he said he's like 5 feet tall.
Ringo Starr is 5 feet tall?
Yes, there you go. I didn't know that. Did you know that?
You're telling me John Herdman, like, would just look down at Ringo Starr,
yes,
and he would be physically imposing.
Think of that battle of the accents. Wouldn't that be the greatest battle of the accents ever? Yeah. Man, yeah, there you go.
Wow.
Something I learned. Among the many things I've learned, and the fact that Stephen Harper is really an automaton. But it's a cool book. And Pete's lived an interesting life. You know, he was discovered, you know, in the airport in Churchill doing PA announcements. He was working for an airline.
How does that work? Just because
you have to buy the book.
Yeah. okay. That's an incredible origin story. It's an incredible book. He talks about incredible Canadians, Peter Mansbridge himself, an incredible and storied Canadian. The Toronto Maple Leafs will resume their season tonight. They have back-to-back games. And we talked to David Amber about this as well the other day about, you know, you get stuck in this division where all you're seeing is Montreal and Ottawa and Edmonton and Vancouver and
Thank
Calgary.
Thank God that's over.
No. Here we go again. And it's not over tonight either because they play the Senators at home on Saturday. So this goaltending thing is curious to me because I've been told that this is a strength now of the Toronto Maple Leafs, that Freddie Anderson, okay, all right, he put together some decent statistics during the regular season, was not a playoff performer. It's pretty consistent when he was healthy in the regular season. Now, Jack Campbell has been pretty good for this team when he's been healthy. Peter Mrazek has been pretty scattershot throughout his entire career. And beyond that, Steven, the job of playing goaltender for this franchise ain't for everybody. And you may have bona fides, which you can argue for and against when it comes to Peter Mrazek. But when you put on the pads and you step into the crease at whatever it is, Maple Leaf Gardens, Scotiabank Arena, sometimes it's different. It's like pitching for the New York Yankees. You're all alone. And if you get off to a slow start, sometimes it's hard to recover.
Who's the last Toronto Maple Leaf goaltender for whom it did not end badly? In Toronto.
Boy.
Like, they might have gone on to, you know, other things, other places. But let's, you know, was it Curtis Joseph? How far do we want to go? You know, Ed Belfour was here. Remember, that was over the after the lockout and the salary cap. And his contract became one of the great albatrosses in hockey history.
Correct.
It's a tough place to, you know, like we always talk about Montreal being a tough place to play goal. But a couple of guys there lasted a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and had storied careers. Now, you know, Patrick Waugh didn't end great for the Montreal Canadiens, but he did fine after. Carey Price has had a great long run. But think about it. You know, how many guys have left here where everybody said, boy, thank God he played for the Leafs?
No, there's very few and far between. Like, yeah, Freddie Anderson, I think the criticism lobbed his way was probably overdone.
Yes.
He was not great during the postseason. It's hard to argue. And you know what? That's kind of a discussion point that gets missed a little bit about last year's playoffs and the seven games against the Montreal Canadiens. Jack Campbell didn't cost him that series. Didn't win it for him, though.
Nope.
Had a chance to.
Mm-hmm.
Was not playing the best offensive team in the history of hockey. And yeah, it would have really helped to score more than one goal between Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner. But I'll tell you what, you flip goaltenders in that series?
Yes.
Maybe you got a different result.
Well, if a goaltender steals a game for you, you're playing in the next round.
Correct.
Right? And then who knows? Who knows how history would have been different?
Yeah. No Austin Matthews again tonight. No Austin Matthews again on Saturday. Who knows when he'll be back, but they said at least this week he'll be out. Kind of bizarre that the Leafs have actually fared pretty well without Austin Matthews. They're 24-13-2, and including some of their best games a season ago. You'll recall the three games in Edmonton against the Oilers where they just totally shut down Connor McDavid, and Leon Draisaitl played without Austin Matthews. I don't necessarily think there's anything to that. But
a statistical anomaly.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's like, yes. Like, you don't get better without your best guy.
No. I mean, Bill Simmons has this thing called the Ewing theory, where they're
yes, he does.
You're familiar with the Ewing theory?
I am. Yes, I am.
Okay. All right. I thought that was, like, too close to Twitter for you to
know. I've lurched into Bill Simmons' world occasionally back in the day, back when he was fresh.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I read his Red Sox book. But, yeah, no, this is not, you know what, Nomar Garciaparra, like we talked about yesterday, is more in line with the Ewing theory. Yeah, obviously there's no Ewing theory potential when it comes to Austin Matthews. But, yeah, this team has played really well without him. How about that? And they played half decently yesterday. Here's hoping that this is not the strategy for this team is to suck the life out of these hockey games, despite the fact that they have some of the best scorers in the league. Hopefully tonight. Yeah. Stylistically a little bit different than yesterday.
I just laughed at that the whole thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's very possible. Because Sheldon Keefe arrived here and was like, oh, here's the guy who's gonna the offensive innovator in those first couple of games. They were fun, free-flowing. It's not really his deal. He's an NHL head coach. He likes to shut the game down. And I think he'll be happy with a 1-0 victory tonight in Ottawa.
Tickets are still on sale.
Yeah. All right. We'll be back tomorrow. You've been listening to The Fan Drive Time. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.